Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon or welcome. This is the Spingola Zone. It is Monday, June 30th, 2014. This is Deanna Spingola. The American Free Press sponsors this weekly radio program. Their website is AmericanFreePress.net. I have been a subscriber to the American Free Press and highly recommend a subscription to that newspaper. I became acquainted with an affiliate of the American Free Press several years ago. It is the Barnes Review, whose website is barnesreview.org. Barnes is spelled B-A-R-N-E-S, barnesreview.org. I am an amateur history buff and really appreciate the great articles in that wonderful historical journal. Please visit those websites as well as my website, which is spingola.com. A very kind and very skilled gentleman took it upon himself to create the website spingolaspeaks.wordpress.com. He has uploaded audio files from my radio programs, including the Spingola specials that I have done, as well as audio files of radio programs on which I am a guest. And for all of his efforts, I thank him very, very, very much. Last week, I kind of goofed, and I failed to see some of the calls that came in. I'm running my own program, and I know I need to be more alert. I'm kind of spoiled because I'm used to a board op taking the calls and then alerting me. I will get better at this, so if you have a question or comment, please feel free to call 347-215-7292, and I promise that I will be more alert and see your calls. Other than that, we will be taking calls or taking questions and comments from the listeners via my email, comment@spingola.com, or from the chat room, spingola.chatango.com. Please do not send email to my regular email address, as I never access it during the program, and I won't see it. So if you email a question that you hope the guest will answer, well, I'm not going to see it until the program is over. My guest today is Werner Bock. All righty, Werner, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Deanna, or good morning for the rest of the country.
Indeed. Well, it's so wonderful to have you join us today. We chatted on the phone in the last few days, and you've kept me up to date about your court appearances and some of the scoundrelly things. Is that a word, scoundrelly? I will just make it a word. The scoundrelly things that the Canadian government has been doing to you and has done to you just in the recent few weeks. So kind of catch us up to date, and then let's talk about some of the things that are imperative that the listeners know about that not only deal with your farm, but with farms and ranches all over the civilized world, or the civilized, well, in Canada, the United States, and other parts of the world.
Well, basically what it is all about, to get the people off the land, and wherever there is an opportunity for big multinational corporations and globalization to get a foot in the door. And one of the main parts is to get the farmers off the land, destroy the local self-sufficiency, especially in food production, and get it all controlled globally by the global interests, and we know what they are up to.
Sure. Now, you said something on the phone to me last week, which I just thought was, it didn't dawn on me until you mentioned it, but you referred to the Agent Orange used in Vietnam that destroyed several hundred thousand acres in that country, making the land just absolutely useless for growing things. And then you said that was relative to what was going on your farm, and I'm thinking, holy cow. Exactly. But done under different circumstances, we tend to look at it out of context instead of looking at it as the whole. And certainly they destroyed a lot of land there, and that's what they're doing elsewhere with Roundup, with Monsanto, and their nasty chemicals that they spray all over the nation.
This is one tool they use in order to get the family farms out of the way and destroy the local self-sufficiency and basically get everything to be controlled by the big multinational corporations. Regions that at one time were self-sufficient in food production destroy that self-sufficiency. And this is where all those modern chemicals come in. And I guess those chemicals are not as modern as people think. They have been around for at least for the last 70, 80 years, those chemicals. They have been known. And where I'm calling from here in New Brunswick, when I immigrated here in 1969, together with a group of other farmers from the old country, we wanted to be self-sufficient in livestock feed production. So we, at the time, most of the feed grain was being imported from Western Canada, from 3,500 miles away, you know, and we didn't see any need for anything like that. We wanted to grow our own grain, mix up our own feed, and basically become self-sufficient and independent from the big feed companies and so on. So we started growing our own grain, and I noticed within 2 or 3 years that something was amiss there. And I noticed whenever a field was emerging, then a small plane would show up from a neighboring airfield, and we are surrounded by several airfields within 25 miles, and this plane would make a few passes over the field, and then within 3 to 4 days, the newly emerged grain crop would wither away and die right off.
Wow.
I was familiar with some of the agricultural herbicides from the old country. And when I approached the so-called experts in the Department of Agriculture, they tried to mislead me, you know. And but it didn't fly with me, you know. So I started doing my own investigation. And this is what I found out, that chemicals in the line of Agent Orange, Roundup, and what else are very specific chemicals, had been dumped in this region for at least the last 60, 70 years, which led to the situation where most of the good farmland, what the forefathers, by the sweat of their brow, had cleared from the forest, had been abandoned and was grown up in alders, and some of those areas had reverted back to forest already. This is clear, visible when you drive some of the back roads here. Then every so often you see right along the roads the old apple orchards.
Wow.
The first pioneers planted when they settled in those areas, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, I just a quick thought that's kind of irrelevant, but the whole concept, the whole German concept during the 30s was to become independent, and independence for a nation or for a farmer is looked upon as, well, it's just not part of the agenda. They want everything interrelated. They want globalization, and they want a monopolization of farmers who are the factory farmers, the people who will ultimately hope to control our entire food industry and our food production and supply.
And one example, it's a blatant example, what I've seen there a few years ago, I think it was somewhere in 2004, 2005, when another hit they gave to the livestock producers, the beef farmers and the hog farmers here in the region, was when, for example, here in New Brunswick, the provincial government, in their wisdom, they allowed the last abattoir to close that had federal inspection, and our main market was where the supermarkets, and they won't accept any livestock products unless they have the federal inspection sticker.
Ah, okay.
And we here on the East Coast, we didn't just only get the hit from the BSE. BSE was no problem here in Eastern Canada. It was a problem in Western Canada and in the big feedlots that were run by the big multinational corporations.
Mm-hmm.
When the government on your side closed the imports from Canada of beef, then Western Canada was unloading its beef here in Eastern Canada.
Oh, my.
And so our prices took a nosedive. And on top of that, to give us the coup de grace, the provincial government allowed Hupp meat packers, that was the main processing plant here in Eastern Canada, to close the doors. And after that, the farmers had to ship their cattle up and hogs up to 1,000 miles before they got butchered.
Wow.
And there is another aspect to that. What does it do when people consume the meat from animals that have been put through this excessive stress and the stress hormones in the meat? What does it do to the people who eat that meat?
Right. I just love animals, and I attempted to watch how they butchered, how they treated the cows, and I just couldn't watch that film at all. I mean, I love cows. I love all kinds of animals, and I once lived where there was a farm right next to me, and the cows would come over to the fence, and I mean, just looking, this is going to sound really weird, but just looking into their eyes, and just, I just felt a connection to these animals. Whenever I have visited a zoo, which I hate to see animals locked up, but whenever I have visited a zoo, I feel a connection to those animals. And I get along with animals. It doesn't matter what kind it is. I just love animals. And I just could not watch that film and see these animals who have feelings, who hurt and feel sorrow and terror. I mean, you can just see the terror in their eyes. And it is just criminal. It's criminal beyond belief how these factory farms treat these animals and maintain them. Even if you're talking about chickens, the factory farms and the way that they treat the chickens and the steroids that they give them. And there are films that also focus on chickens. And gosh, it just makes me sick.
Look, Diana, it's a fact of life. You know, we eat meat. Most of us, we eat meat. But the animals that are being kept in order to produce that meat, we shall keep them humanely, and we shall cut the suffering. You know, when they're being killed, we are supposed to keep that to a minimum.
Of course.
This is what I understood during the Third Reich. They had very extensive animal protection laws. You know,
exactly.
For example, they outlawed the checking, you know, without being stunned the animals. You know, they would cut their throat and let them slowly for the next few minutes slash around and bleed to death.
Yeah, you're talking about the kosher slang and the kosher murder.
Yeah. And anyone who has any kind of a human being, when an animal has to be killed for food, it shall not be done in this kind of a way.
Exactly. Yes.
You know, only monsters do that.
Of course. Absolutely. And I am very fortunate that I can get beef and chicken from somebody that has an organic farm. I'm extremely fortunate that I can do that.
Well, anyway, there are so many things that need to be addressed by and brought to the attention of the people who are still ignorant or choose to be ignorant.
Right. That's a good choice. Choose to be ignorant. Some people choose to be ignorant, and they don't want to believe what they hear. Yesterday I did a program on vaccines and on psychiatric drugs, and one of the things that the first guest said was that religious people, and I think this is applicable to other people also, that religious people were the last people to believe some of the things about vaccines that they heard, because I think that they just cannot comprehend, and as I said, it's applicable to a lot of other people, they just cannot comprehend that there is such evilness in the world that that these evil people would be so cruel to animals and to children and to older people and to others. They just cannot comprehend it. But it's imperative that people like you and other people speak out about what these monsters, these evil, wicked monsters are doing. I'm just so grateful for people like you. And you have suffered because of what you've done, because you have fought back. You have suffered. You've been arrested. You've been incarcerated. They've been trying to silence you for a long time. But you just won't keep silent, will you?
Well, I couldn't, I basically couldn't believe that things have gone downhill that far, and that there would be that much evil and wickedness and cover-up and cowardness in the highest places in the government, people we are supposed to trust.
Those are really the last people on the planet that anybody should trust, because the government, all governments now work for and in behalf of the corporations. They are not in place, nor any of their ABC agencies are not in place to protect the people. They are in place to protect the corporations, which of course includes the factory farms.
And their shareholders.
Yes. Yeah.
And their shareholders. And the shareholders, they stick their heads in the sand. They don't want to know where their income comes from.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Anyway, there are lots of people who have been in the same boat as I've been in, and thanks to the grace of God and through some friends, who stood by my side, where I hope you don't mind when I count you.
Oh, you better count me as a friend.
I'm still around.
Yes. And we're grateful that you are, and it's because I think some entity is protecting you, because it's just it's amazing, because so many other people have been silenced, but here you are still speaking out.
Look, the Lord gave us our senses to make use of them, and not to dull them down with drugs and what else, or alcohol and whatever.
Sure.
So we shall make use of our senses. And if we don't use our God-given senses, we choose not to use them, and sure. turn a blind eye to the evil that's around us, then we become guilty just as much.
Sure. Now,
when I said about the animals, you know, look what they do to human beings all over the world. The military-industrial complex, you know, sent young men, you know, young fellas sent them all over the world and create so much misery, you know, blow people to smithereens that have done nothing to them. When do the people ever wake up and not put up with this evil anymore?
Right.
What I said earlier on your show, you know, one famous man, I don't remember who it was, he said, all it takes for evil to succeed is for good people to do nothing. And I just...
Is that Edmund Burke? Or?
Yeah, and I added, and when good people do nothing, then they're not good people anymore.
Ah, that is wonderful.
And basically, you know, all you so-called born-again Christians, you know, on Sunday, I see the big parking lots filled up, you know, most of them with late model cars. They don't even want to wake up. They don't want to know.
Right. Well, I think that there is a general feeling that we can trust government, even though the government has lied. And I get very irritated when I hear people that I have associated with for a very long time getting up in a public arena and thanking God that we have the military and that they're protecting us and fighting for our freedoms. I just want to stand up and say, which freedoms do you think that the people who are slaughtering the people in the Middle East are protecting? Which freedoms is that? I just get so angry because people... I don't know what they're doing. They're not reading. They're getting all of their information from the television. And of course, that is all controlled by these same evil, wicked corporations. And I just get livid, absolutely livid when I think about how ignorant people are when there is so much information available that they will not read. I don't know. It's just...
Diane, they don't want to wake up because then they have to grow some backbone.
I'm sure you're right. I'm sure you're right. Because when you learn something, you have a responsibility to act upon what you've learned. And sometimes that responsibility is just too burdensome for people to accept. So it's easier to just keep their head in the sand.
And what prevents a lot of people from speaking out is fear. With all the evil that's around us and the evil methods, most of us, we can't even imagine how evil those that are in charge, that are behind the scene, directing everything, to what kind of depravity they are capable of. And this basically creates such a fear factor within the population.
Sure.
The most common answer I get, you can fight City Hall, you know, we can change things anyway, you know, and so on. But at the same time, they condone the slaughter of millions of people, of innocent people. How can they live with themselves?
I think it's herd mentality, and it's also self-censorship because it's a consensus thinking. And as I've mentioned several times on this program, it is easier to control a group than it is to control an individual. Because when you get a group of people, and we're talking about any group, and it doesn't need to even be a recognizable group. It could be just people in general. But when you get a group of people, and then you have the oddball who actually raises some legitimate questions, then other people in the group are going to castigate the individual. They're going to vilify the individual. They're going to call her names. I mean, I have lost, I can't tell you how many friends I've lost, or the people who avoid me. People avoid me I have family members who have not, who refuse to talk to me because they think I'm a nut.
Well, as I say, in the end it will come out who are the nuts. But I hope that then it won't be too late.
Indeed.
By every one of us.
Indeed.
But anyway, you know.
Well, it was Schmedley Butler who said war is a racket. And he said that, I think it was probably in 1935 that he wrote that little book. And, I mean, that's been, you know, almost 100, well, not 100 years, 85 years ago or more. And yet, that was before the Second World War, of course. And he described exactly what was going on. He talked about the different corporations who made money because of that war. He gave figures about how their product was used by the government. The government would go in and order a bunch of the company's products, and their profits, those companies' profits, would increase during warfare by you know, 100% or more. And so, but people knew. There were some people who knew back then. And, of course, like so many others, he was silenced pretty quickly after he wrote that little book. He ended up, his superiors suggested that he go into one of the government hospitals for a little rest. And he never came out. He died. He never came out of that hospital. Now, my grandfather was his aide, his military aide. They were in the Marine Corps together. And in fact, they wrote a book together. You know, so I have a particular respect and liking for Schmedley Butler.
And see, already in the 20s, the very same banking interests and big companies, they raised themselves up already the next enemy to fight, in order to give another money injection into the military-industrial complex when they started to build up Stalin's militaries.
Right, yes, of course, with the lend-lease, yeah.
One fellow who opened my eyes about this was a Hungarian George.
Oh, yes,
A few years ago, and he stated all the shipments of metalworking equipment, you know, to build up the arms factory in the furthest reaches of Siberia, you know, for Stalin and his
right.
army.
Right. Now, I talk about that in my third book, which just came out a couple of weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. I don't have my supply of them yet, so I'm not that it's available at Amazon. I hate to be self-promoting, but I just thought I'd throw that in. But yes, there was Lend-Lease, and of course they started building up the Soviet Union way back in the 1920s, as soon as Stalin took over. Absolutely.
Even so, they knew what kind of a murderous system.
That's why they did it.
Communist system was.
Sure, it's the same
and
kind of system we have here.
The same group that built up the this murderous system, the Soviet Union.
Right.
You know, that were basically aligning themselves, you know, and the Cold War came, you know, until 1945. And then they had already another reason to for arms production because of the Cold War and the communist threat.
Sure.
They always built up themselves the next enemy and the next enemy so they can capitalize on it.
Sure. And the whole reason, too, for the Cold War was so that they could weaponize Israel. I can't remember who exactly admitted that. I wrote it somewhere, but that's one of the reasons that they had this phony Cold War. But, you know, I was thinking just recently about warfare. It's kind of a double whammy kind of a operation, because when you have a country that's engaged in war, you have a great deal of men, young men, 19, 20-year-olds, 21-year-olds, under your power, under your jurisdiction. And it is during warfare, when you have control over so many people, that the government can then go in and do the mandatory vaccine program. And without warfare, you would not have that opportunity. So it's kind of a double whammy. Not only do you get these people who are indoctrinated via the government schools to adopt this patriotism, which is, what is it, the last effort of a scoundrel, that these people all think that they're doing something that's meritorious, that is wonderful, that they're going to protect us from the outside enemy, the external enemy, when in fact they then put themselves in the hands of the U.S. government, who is controlled by the pharmaceutical industry, who can then use that great big huge group of men as guinea pigs for their vaccines.
And agenda is being approached from so many different angles. Plus, that group of young men, once they start waking up, and before they wake up, they have to basically indoctrinate them, you know, draft them into the army and so on, so they don't wake up. Because if they wake up about all the shenanigans that are being pulled on the population, you know, they would be the most devastating force against those controllers.
Sure.
Within their own country.
Exactly. And part of that indoctrination, if they don't think that they have them completely indoctrinated, when people are in boot camp, not only do they learn to march and shoot and go through the Quonset huts with gas masks on and all the other things, they attend classes where they are indoctrinated on military history, and where they are indoctrinated on how they must go and fight the enemy. So there's indoctrination from the time that a child enters school until they go off to kill people.
Basically, the one who controls the history, the writing of the history, they control the people.
Sure, sure. The victors write the histories. And that's another reason why people are so indoctrinated. And then after they write these histories, then you have Hollywood Jews making movies of the victor's version of history, which contributes to more brainwashing and more brainwashing. It was really funny. The other day, I got an email from someone that's been a guest on this program, and he had purchased my book and was reading the first one. And he said, he was kidding, of course, and he said that, I know that the Indians were fine because he'd watched so many John Wayne movies, and he went through a list of all the movies, and he said, so I know that you're wrong. And of course, he was just being light-minded, but it was really funny, really funny.
Well, the way I look at it, here in North America, people, they're basically like people that have been living on an island. And all the information they got, most of the information they got, it was being controlled information.
Right.
So, and then you add entertainment and popularization of the Hollywood movies and the Hollywood version of history. What can else be expected from people?
Right.
You know.
Right.
And but now with the internet and more people traveling in other parts of the world, now this official version that has been presented to the people, you know, through the school system, through news, through the media and entertainment, that version doesn't fly anymore.
Right.
And as I say, we all have the responsibility to seek the truth, and not. It's the same way with junk food, you know. If you want to eat junk food and reap the consequences, you know, then sooner or later you have to wake up, you know, when illness comes in and everything else.
Sure.
Basically, the people, especially in North America, have been raised up on an information junk food diet, right from young on when the little kids are sitting in front of the television.
Right. Issue about groupthink. We find it. I have seen it in action. Several years ago, I was part of a network of 9/11 truthers, and my name was on a website saying that if people wanted information, that they could contact me. And I had a gentleman who was a member of a police force in an adjacent city. He contacted me, and he came over, and we chatted for a couple of hours. I gave him a lot of information, a bunch of pamphlets and things, and he attempted to alert other members of the police force that he was a part of, and they just would have absolutely none of it. So you find that this herd mentality exists. As we said before, it exists in certain groups. And of course, when you're employed, as he was, in a situation where you have to march to the tune of the head drummer, then for you to go out of, out of line, for you to step out of line, it could be detrimental to your employment. And so there's all kinds of pressures that people experience, which is a part of this group think. And I have to think that this was initiated because, well, it used to be back in the late 1800s and early in the last century, that people were more independent. They had independent businessmen. They weren't part of a corporate structure. It was before corporatocracy really took hold. But you had a lot of independent business people. And so you had more independent thinking. You had more people used to visit on the front porch. They weren't so isolated as we are now. And so when you had independent businessmen, you had more independence, same as being an independent rancher. But they do not, the powers that be do not want any independent anything. They don't want parents to homeschool their kids. They want all the kids into the public schools. They want the workforce all corralled within the corporate structure. So they don't want any independent business people. And I witnessed something that I witnessed in my travels. I used to be a sales rep for several textile companies, and I used to travel throughout Illinois, Wisconsin, Iowa. Where else did I go? A lot of places, I mean. But one of the things that I noted was that a lot of the independent retailers, the small stores, the small fabric stores, all of a sudden, they were all closing up, and you had big, huge Walmarts springing up in all of these small towns. And it was a demise of the independent business person. And so you have this monopolization, not only of business, but of thought, which is very scary and very, very deliberate on the part of the powers that be.
Well, as I say, you know, when they got they want to make everything uniform.
Sure.
And another thing what they want to make uniform is the gene pool. Because that way they don't get so many independent thinkers that can throw the monkey wrenches into their plans and warn the herd.
Yes.
You know. And as I say, it's just... My dad, for a few years, he was a policeman in town, you know, and they had their schoolings and so. And basically, one of the basic lessons there to learn. This, when you want to catch a cook, you have to learn to think like a cook in order to anticipate his or her moves. You know, and I think this is what we have to do too, in order to figure out what's going on, all the shenanigans that are going on. We have to put ourselves into their position. What would you do if you would throw all morals overboard in order to achieve your ultimate goal of total global dominance and global control of all the life on this planet? You know, as I say, we have to learn to think in abstracts, but not adapt it into our own mentality. But we have to learn how to think how the cooks think.
Yes, critical thinking. It's a lost art, I think. People don't do it anymore. It's much easier just to accept what the majority thinks and feels because, well, gosh, then you won't be out of step. You won't be out of step when the parade is going by. Because those people who are out of step, well, they just become the target of the herd mentality.
And we have seen, you know, every time when large groups of people or countries or empires, when they march in step, what will be the end result? There will be an awful lot of bloodshed and destruction.
Right. Yikes.
And I think in North America, you know, a lot of the world has been looking envious to North America because of the immense resources and the wide open spaces and everything. And it could be an example about living and let live.
Sure.
You know, as
yeah.
long as we in one way or another contribute to society, you know, and pull our own weight, you know,
sure.
there's no bureaucrat and no kind of somebody who puts himself on a soapbox, you know, to tell us what to do, as long as we fulfill our duty within society.
Right, right. Okay, we will take calls at 347-215-7292, and I promise I will actually look at the call board, and so if somebody does call in, we will take your calls. But I have this theory, because you are part of the group of people that moved from Germany following World War II, that moved from Germany at the invitation of the Canadian government. And it's my theory, it's certainly speculative, that the Canadian government was working in cahoots with powers that be, and to get the young men out of Germany and get them into a more controlled environment, make them all kinds of promises of land and all kinds of things. But I think that they wanted to water down the strength of Germany so that Germany would forget the reason that they were fighting the bankers, that the young men in Germany would be disseminated throughout, you know, out of the country and into other countries, so that they would not recall what Germany had accomplished. What are your thoughts?
I said to you there a while earlier on the show, people who built their future on lies of the past, those people will have no future. And basically in most of the industrialized countries, the people have been lied to about their past, about the real history, you know.
Sure.
But when I came here to Canada and several of my countrymen, they came here to Canada to farm, I realized that the same stunt had been pulled off on the local people, on the local population, and too many had given up, you know. Basically, they took on the attitude, why struggle, you know, when I can get on welfare and unemployment.
Oh, sure.
Better off than when I'm working.
Sure.
And the same shenanigans have been pulled off here on the local farmers, you know, about this illegal dumping of those vegetation control chemicals on their farmland for at least the last 60, 70 years.
Sure.
Those so-called experts in the Department of Agriculture, in the Department of the Environment, federally and provincially, they have been lying to the people.
Exactly.
Outright lying and covering up those crimes.
Sure.
And then a few years later, some of them, you know, then they want to do some grandstanding and appear as the champions for the environment. And right now here in New Brunswick, about the failed forestry industry, where most of the forests have been cut, and basically now the government wants to hand over the forest to those big companies, especially here,
sure,
the Irving Company, now for the next 25 years.
Right.
You know. And
Werner, we have a phone call. So let's take a phone call.
Yeah.
Okay, I hate to interrupt.
No, no, that's all right.
Okay, let's take a phone call from 610-610. Okay, you're on 610.
Yes, hi, Diana. This is Busena. How are you?
Oh, bless your heart.
How are you?
Thank you.
Say hi to your wonderful guest, Mr. Buck. How are you?
Oh, not too bad. I hope everything's fine with you. Just try to hang in there as long as I can.
Well, you are a great model for a fighter for your land.
And
I really appreciate
you. So are you,
fine. Allah bless you, Diana. Bless your listeners. It's such a good topic. I just want to add two comments. First, I mean, as part of the genocide that U.S. was launching on Iraq a long time ago, one of the first decrees or laws that Paul Bremer, which he is head of the so-called Coalition Provisional Authority of Bush in Baghdad, one of his most important laws, is a law called Update Iraq's Intellectual Property Law to meet the current internationally organized standard of protection, and by that, he wanted to. He made it a law that Iraqi farmers will not be able to save their own seeds, but they have to buy the seed from the American company, especially Monsanto and those all poisonous companies. So that was one of the first laws that implemented, and really it did harm a lot of farmers. It turned the fertile agriculture Iraqi land to a desert. I mean, it's so bad. The effect of it is so bad. A lot of farmers lost their land. In addition to the war and the militia that have been backed by U.S., I mean, this law make it so hard for them, and a lot of people protest it, but I mean, it's really bad. That's one, I mean, I think it has connection to what Mr. Buck is saying. That's in Iraq. Another thing, in another land, I mean, in Somalia, I mean, if you think why America had invaded Somalia in the 90s, late 80s, Somalia became a very big country to export bananas, and their kind of bananas was so it has such a nice smell, Diana. Really, if you eat a Somalian banana, which they were exporting to all the Arab countries, you will see every other banana is not that tasty. It has such a nice scented smell, and even in the pop operas and the songs, it smells nice as the Somalian banana. So of course the American army, who is a militia for the fruit companies of America, came and destroyed the land of Somalia. So this part of the genocide against the agriculture any agricultural country in the world that, I mean, done by U.S. I really understand what Mr. Buck is going through, because we have seen this, and us as Iraq and other Arab companies has gone through the hardship of that. So I really appreciate your fighting. Keep on fighting. That's what I want to say to you and to your wonderful guest, Diana.
Well, that is very interesting, because the United Fruit Company has had control of the banana market for a very, very long time. Honestly, I have never heard of a Somalia banana until you just talked about it.
There is a famous singer in Egypt called Aida Sha'ar. One of her songs, she is praising and romanticizing how nice is the Somalian bananas. And they were a small country, and they were protected by the Arabs, all the Arab socialist country, and Iraq sends them teachers, and they want to. The Somalian government at that time, the late 70s and 80s, they have this dream that covering the market of the Arab world and reaching other international market with the food of Somalia. And the Arab company, Arab socialist leader at that time, want to do this called self-sustaining. We eat whatever we grow, and we export what we don't need. And so they have big dreams. So they were really targeted, or they are jeopardizing the vicious companies of America. So that's why they crashed, and Somalia is never coming back. They put Al Qaeda group in them, and they are killing the people. That's the way America does its work. They go to a country, they destroy it, and then they put their own militia there to complete the other work. So that's what's happening. Iraq was a basket, a fruit of basket for, variety of, very, very tasty fruit of basket rice. We have some kind of rice called Iraqi basmati, which the scent of it, you can't imagine how tasty, things that I use when I grow up, dear Diana, Mr. Buck, we eat things that's really tasty. When I came to this country, food is so tasteless. Really, meat, chicken, is everything is so tasteless. It's not as good as my country, even under the embargo, even all the wars of America on us. But they destroy everything. Whenever every country that has good, healthy food, they destroy it, and by destroying that, they destroy the land and the people. That's their plan. So, yeah. Wow. So that's what I want to say to you, Diana. And this genocide going on and on, and even Iraqis now is revolting and want to kick the American puppet government out. And everyone who tries to revolt against the government that imposed by America, they label it as Al Qaeda, as a terrorist, and they go. And they go after it. And Iraqi people are revolting all over Iraq now. And what they are labeling it, oh, they are Al-Qaeda affiliates, they are terrorists, they are jihadists. And Obama and Biden are sending their drones to kill civilians. And they don't show you what the drones are doing in Iraq or Yemen. Just a few pictures from the areas that be liberated by the revolutionary people, and you saw the destruction of the drones there. It's horrible. But nobody can say the American army are the real terrorists, or the American government are the real terrorists. But if you open your mouth and revolt against the injustice, against the genocide, that the American implanted government, or the puppet government of Baghdad, are doing to Iraq. No, they label you terrorist. If you want to protect your land, you're a criminal, you're a terrorist, you're not. And that's the same thing. They do it. They did it in every country they targeted.
Right. And this started with the Philippines in 1898. Did the same thing. took over the, yes. the resources.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Werner, what do
well,
you...
Well, thank you, Diana. Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, Diana.
Werner, what do you think about what Bhuthena has said?
Well, some more information, that some more pieces of the puzzle.
Absolutely. I just thank you so much, Bhuthena. After you,
thank
were,
you.
You were on the program last Sunday, and I... It took me a few days to get over that program because
yeah.
I just my heart aches for the people who are so victimized by this brutality. And,
yeah.
and for your family. You know,
your father.
Go ahead.
Yeah, my father was an expert in agriculture. He's agricultural expert. He's engineer. Agriculture technology and mechanism, and the way we used to grow farms in Iraq, the governmental farms. I mean, we everything organic, everything healthy, no pesticide. One of things that really, Allah bless his soul in heaven, for my father. He was a very good farmer, and he used to, I mean, our yard, our front yard is just like an orchid, and the farmers that he was, managing, it yields more crops than he even ever thought. So he ended up, when the harvesting time, he ended up, he doesn't know what to do with the overflowing the crops that, I mean, the land yield more crops because you use a good, healthy system. So he ended up the profuse of the or the other extra quantity of the crops. He ended up renting trucks and giving them to the nearby neighborhoods. Each neighborhood had boxes and boxes of fruit and vegetables because he said, I don't know where to do with it. I mean, it's such a good way. It's such a healthy way. It makes people eat healthy food. The land yield more than, I mean, it's, Allah put a great blessing in the land, and that's his passion. And when the American came and destroys all the farms, all the factories, food factories, everything, really that hit him hard because a lot of these things he built it by his hand, and he saw his country crushing in front of him, and he couldn't do. I mean mostly the sadness and the depression killed him.
Yeah.
So. My great support to you, Mr. Buck, and Allah bless you, and hopefully we'll save our land.
Indeed. Well, thank you.
In every place, all the land, all the earth is Allah's land, and Allah's land, and hopefully the good people will save it.
Yes. And I do believe that natural farming, organic farming, does produce much, much, much greater yields. And, I mean, I've witnessed this just in my, when I was had a big organic garden in Idaho, when I lived in Idaho. I had so much, the earth is really will yield sufficient to feed everybody.
Yes, dear. I mean, say poor Africa is poor. Africa is not poor. Africa is poor because the colonizing powers destroy it. Asia
right.
is not poor. U.S. is not poor. South Africa. Every land has its own characteristic, and it yields good crops. But the problem with the evil people who goes there. Those wandering parasites who goes there and destroy it. That's the problem.
Indeed.
Nobody is poor. The evil people impoverished the people and make them poor.
Indeed. Wow. Well,
thank you, Diana.
Thank you so much for calling in.
I'm sorry I made you sad, but Allah bless you.
Oh, bless you too. Thank you so much.
Pray for my dad and Mr. Buck. Pray for my dad. I mean, they used to call him the flower engineers because he filled our backyard with variety of flowers. So whenever any guest comes to see our house, to see us, any guest, he ended up with a bouquet of his own grown flowers. So they used to call him the flower man or the flower engineer. He loves the flowers a lot.
Yes.
Diana, we when in the morning when spring and summer comes, Iraqis used to grow very scented flowers called gardenia.
Oh, right.
And he used to wake up in the morning and took a nice this porcelain bowls and he filled it with water and he put the gardenias in it and he put it on the main in the kitchen table so the scent will come through all the house and we wake up on his scent. So that was my father.
When I was growing up, we had a gardenia bush in the backyard, right outside my window. And
does it have a smell, Diana?
Oh, it was wonderful. It was just wonderful smell. I love the smell of gardenias. Well, bless your heart. Thank you so much for calling
in.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for educating, and thanks for your wonderful guest. And I pray for all the good people.
And we will pray for you, too, and for your country.
Thank you, honey.
Okay,
thank
bye-bye.
You. Thank you, Diana. Thank you, Mr. Buck. Bye-bye.
Thank
bye-bye.
You.
Bye-bye.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
All righty. Anybody that would like to call in, that number again is 347-215-7292. Werner, that is an example of exactly what the military is doing. And it does, and it has always done that in every country. If you think about Vietnam, you know, you and I talked about Vietnam. Same thing, right?
It's the nature of the beast, and people have to make a choice. Do they want to be part of the beast, or do they want to be part of humanity?
Indeed. I think something else that they do, when they go into a country, and this is what they did in the Philippines, is that the U.S. military, under the direction, of course, of the U.S. government, made it mandatory that everybody in the Philippines would get a smallpox vaccination. And so they rounded up all of these people, and of course, the people, they didn't know what smallpox was because they were a virgin population. They were, you know, kind of isolated, and they ate the food that they grew, had fresh fruits and vegetables, raised their chickens, did all of these very, very healthy things. And so nobody had ever had smallpox. And the U.S. rounded up all of these people, and they forced them to have smallpox vaccinations. Now, there were some people that left and went out into the bush, area, but they vaccinated everybody that lived in the cities. And within a couple of years, you had an epidemic of smallpox. So what they did, actually, and of course we talked about vaccines, and when you shoot a live virus into a body, that body usually gets whatever is being shot into their body. If you shoot them with smallpox, they're going to develop smallpox. I mean, it just makes sense. But that is what they do. They mess up the land, take over the resources, take over the farms, and then vaccinate the people. And I wonder if, and I should have asked Uthena, if they made it mandatory in Iraq for people to have vaccines. I should have asked her.
Diana, another thing what they did, they destroyed all the infrastructure, the sewage system, the water supply, and everything. So everything got polluted, and how many hundreds of thousands of people died, especially children and elderly, of typhoid and cholera and all those diseases.
Indeed. Right. In Iraq, yes, of course. They destroyed in the first Gulf War. They destroyed all the water system, and they only had 4% of the electrical power left. And, you are so right. I'm sorry, I seem to be talking a lot today, but...
And then there's something else about... they did the same thing in Libya. But there is another aspect. In Iraq, who was the fellow who was responsible from the American government? What was his name? Bremer.
Paul Bremer, yes. B-R-E-M-E-R.
There is one thing how I identify a lot of the people that are of, they like to call themselves Jews. They take on the names either of precious stones, precious metals, or the towns and cities where they settled in.
All right, okay.
Paul Bremer sounds to me that he's of the same club.
Might be. I know that that he got mighty wealthy after his tour of duty there, after he'd left. And of course, we also know that a lot of the contractors who went to Iraq supposedly to build the country back up made a lot of money thanks to the U.S. taxpayer.
Basically, predators.
Sure. Predators, yes, the same ones that went into Europe.
Like jackals, where the lion does the killing. The
yes.
jackals and the hyenas, they move in.
Yes.
And the vultures, they move in. And that is with every country where they go to war. Then you have this whole flock of vultures that move in. And then since, the call is a lady there from Iraq. She, Husseina, yeah, she mentioned about Iraq. Didn't they do the same thing in Libya?
Yeah.
Gaddafi was in, and his people were in the process of basically making their part of the Sahara Desert a Garden of Eden.
Yes.
With the 6,000 kilometer, the artificial river where they wanted to make the desert bloom, and when they would have succeeded in making the desert bloom, I think Israel would have faced a stiff competition for their citrus fruits.
Yes. And of course those citrus fruits, those groves, were planted not by the Jews that invaded Palestine. They were planted by the Palestinians, and they had, those were their groves, and the Jews just moved in and took over. But something else, too, that we need to make a connection, is the Marshall Plan after World War II. The Marshall Plan was designed to allow certain American corporations to go in and rebuild the countries, including Germany, to rebuild the country. And the deal was that the Marshall Plan would allow Germany to get money, to get a loan, but the loan had to be used for American corporations.
But
so it's the very same thing.
And about 50 years ago, I read about many of the big companies in Germany. Who were the shareholders, the major shareholders in those companies?
Wow.
And I guess it's not a hard guess to make.
Yes.
You know, but Husseina, she mentioned there about Somalia. I understand in Somalia there is another aspect. The big tankers, there is a shipping line right across along their coastline, and what they have been doing for years, they were basically the tankers, they were dumping toxic waste into and poisoning their fishing grounds.
Oh, yes.
You know, and that is why what they call the Somali pirates, they just plain were fighting back.
Oh, yes, yeah. Well, she brought up some other countries, too. And, I mean, this has been going on. And of course, Britain did the same thing. They they would go in to a country, poison the wells, set up concentration camps. That's what America did in the Philippines. They set up concentration camps, and they concentrated all of the people who would have fought against the incursion of the Americans into their land. And they simply concentrated them in one area so they could control them.
And Britain did the same thing down in South Africa, the Boer War.
Yes, yes.
Put the civilians.
The Boer War, mm-hmm.
The family members, they put them in concentration camps.
Right.
And the black people that were loyal to them, and they killed 60,000. Those were men, no, those were women, children, and old people.
Right.
Because the Boer men, they were fighting the British forces.
Right.
And
yes.
All the misery that came afterwards in South Africa, that was being caused by British policies, where
yes.
they basically, as soon as they gained control of most of South Africa and the big mining companies, that's when they had migrant workers, shipped migrant workers in there. And that's the reason where suddenly then the black people became the majority.
Wow. Well, it certainly is. Somebody mentioned Nelson Mandela in the chat room. And a lot of times people think, oh, Mandela was, oh, he was such a good man. And I've had guests on the program who say otherwise. But when you're talking about poisoning the well, whether it's done on a national scale or whether it's done to one farmer, it's the same principle. And when you think about what has happened with your cows and it's just
and with the land, and I try to remedy the land by putting on huge amount of composted manure on and everything, because I didn't get any answers, only lies from the Department of Agriculture, from the experts, and from the Department of the Environment. When I asked for definite chemical testing being done, I only succeeded once in the 80s with the agriculture minister, who was not aware of the issue. Doug Tyler, we started out with basic element testing in the soil, and an area that had, where the whole vegetation a year earlier, everything had turned white, and then it stopped growing in that area. And I concluded right away that was chlorosis, you know.
Wow.
Basically, it sterilizes the hell right out of the soil, and then the plants turn chlorotic, they turn white. I remember that from the old country when we were growing sugar beets, you know, we had to apply high amounts of potassium chlorate, you know, and then every so often I would see sugar beet leaves that were completely white. But anyway, the test proved out in those areas there was up to 10 times the chloride level in the soil. And then I did some more research, and there is a long-term soil sterilant where a soil can be sterilized so it won't grow for up to several decades. And it's called sodium chlorate.
Wow.
But this is all basic stuff, and it was always denied and covered up time and time by the government. And the only farms they have been fostering here are the big farms that go, basically that farm the Monsanto Bay and that farm the big multinational chemical companies want them to farm.
Right.
You know?
It is interesting how these big factory farms do very well, and it's the independent farmers that have all this trouble. And when you look at California, which is kind of the Garden State, although New Jersey is called the Garden State, but a lot of produce comes out of California. And California government, the local government, I mean, they seem to be more interested in some stupid little fish, saving a fish, rather than the farmers that are farming there. And so they've taken water, for instance, out of San Joaquin Delta area, which used to be a great farming area. It's just interesting what they are doing.
What I understood, what is it, the Klamath River?
Mm-hmm.
They blew the irrigation and the hydro dams, they blew them up. And basically, sustainable energy generation is basically replaced in by nuclear power plants. Basically the rug is being pulled out from underneath the farmers who needed this water from those dams for irrigation.
Sure.
And there goes the food self-sufficiency. How much food is now being imported into the United States?
Sure.
Are we still food self-sufficient? I don't think anymore.
Right, and that's the way that the World Trade Organization is set up. In fact, after the war in Vietnam ended, they still resisted having the World Trade Center in their country. And so the U.S. military put embargo against Vietnam until they agreed to join the World Trade Organization. And it's all part of the globalization to keep countries from being independent. And we have to go back again and look at the example of Germany. Germany they threw the bankers out. They increased the production of the land. They taught the farmers how to produce more effectively. And Germany was wonderful in what they accomplished. And if they could accomplish it, being kind of isolated as they were, being in the middle of Europe as they were, just think of all the other European countries that would follow suit. Get rid of the bankers, and the bankers are the ones that promote the World Trade Organization. They promote globalization. They promote worldwide vaccines. And what would have happened? It would have been wonderful.
And the bankers were the ones that were financing the communists. And the end result was, with the communists coming to power in the Soviet Union, in Russia, after 78 years or what it was, in power, with all the advanced sciences and so, and the scientists and the big experts in charge, they couldn't accomplish what the stupid peasants, farmers were able to accomplish before, feed the people of Russia.
And
years ago I read a statistic, and under the communist system, people were still allowed to have 1 or 1.5 acre of ground. And basically what it boiled down to, the statistics, they showed that on 2.5% of the total agricultural land that still was privately owned in small plots, they were producing 40% of all the food.
Oh my gosh.
As I say, I'm basically stuck on quite often on statistics.
Yes.
And when you pay attention to the statistics, then most of the dialectic and the spin that's been put on by mainstream media and vested interest, you can blow them out of the water.
Indeed. Oh, my goodness. All right. Listeners, feel free to call in with questions or comments at 347-215-7292, and I promise that I'm watching the board this week. I'm not gonna fail to answer phone calls like I did last week. I was just a goof off, I guess. I was just doing other things, but anyway, we will take your phone calls.
Diana, you mentioned another thing came up during the conversation, and that was about as soon as the militaries and the colonizers came in and brought the so-called progressive ways of living and the medical system and vaccination in, that's when all the diseases and sicknesses started where those people never had a problem with before.
Right.
And here it might be worthwhile to look into the work of Dr. Weston A. Price.
Oh, yes.
The Weston A. Price Foundation. When he studied people right around the world before they got in contact with the so-called modern world, and after they got in contact, all the health problems that rose up, all the dental problems and all the problems that were associated with a new way of life.
Right. And this is applicable not just to those populations, but to the animals within those populations, as we can apply it to the animals within our own society.
And who were the main beneficiary, or who profited the most?
Well,
this, the whole sickness industry.
Sure, pharmaceutical industry, yep.
Hospitals and everything out of next to nothing that create a huge industrial complex.
Exactly.
In the same way as a military industrial complex and several other industries, we need them as much as we need, to the extent as we need another hole in the head. And here it comes in with the Hegelian dialectic.
Right. And, you know, it's very interesting. People used to take care of themselves. Families knew how to take care of their own illnesses. They used the spices and the herbs and the things that they were familiar with. And we often hear that Columbus set off to find spices and herbs. And we think, oh, well, when you're a kid, you think, oh, of course, yes. Well, cinnamon was good. It's good to put on your breakfast cereal. So, sure, they went off to find these spices so they could have tasty food. No, 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 no. Spices were used because that is what is available to us to heal our own sicknesses and to make us well. Let me just share a story with you. That I have done a lot of family history research, and one of the stories that I recall, and this is actually a story about my first husband's family, two of the boys in his family were out in the field, and they had those curved knives, a skiff, and they were, you know, cutting hay, and one of the boys accidentally opened the abdomen of his brother inadvertently. He carried him back to the home log cabin, and his mother put ash from the fireplace into the wound, and she sewed him up. She sewed him back together. You know, whatever was cut, she sewed back together. And this boy lived until he was very old, into his 70s. And when I found that story, and it's true, I know it's true because I validated it. And I'm thinking, my goodness, that is an amazing. That is really amazing, don't you think?
You know, there comes something to mind. An old fella, he passed away there in the meantime. He grew up out west, and his father had a general store, and I think he had a blacksmith shop. And he said, in the winter, he went into town, and on the way back, he didn't realize that he was freezing his legs.
Ah.
And he said when he came home, they had to carry him out of the carriage, you
uh-huh.
know.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I would have lost my legs. But he said, my father, he set me on a chair, and he had two big vats with kerosene.
Ah, sure.
And he made me to sit for about a day with the lake submerged in the kerosene.
Indeed.
And he said, I don't know, I tried to figure out, it probably kept the air from getting to it, and it, he said, otherwise my legs would have turned gangrene and I would have lost the leg.
Wow. Well, Rockefeller's biggest market areas was in China early on. because they used a lot of kerosene for lighting, for medicinal purposes, and so the Rockefellers went after that market. I'm talking early on, late 1800s, because they were aware of that, of the benefits of kerosene, and of course we can apply that also to turpentine, which is, as Tony Pantelaresco reminded us, or reminded me, is an essential oil. And essential oils are things that people used to be aware of and they used to use, and people knew how to take care of themselves. They learned from their mothers or their grandmothers, and it's a lost art that we need to reestablish. We need to learn how to use these the things that we've been given. Go ahead.
Your guest, Dr. Jennifer Daniels, there a few months ago, she mentioned about turpentine, but
yes,
it has to be natural turpentine. The way the poor people and the slaves used to use it to cure all kind of illnesses.
Right.
And get rid of parasites, you know, and anything.
Right.
Particularly an all-round, wasn't it one of the board operators on, was it on RBN or another, where you had the program on, he was taken there, what, a teaspoonful of, or 1.5 teaspoonful of turpentine?
Well, oh, really? I think it was somebody in the chat room.
Oh, yeah, or whatever.
Yeah.
You know? And then towards the end of the show, you ask him if he still was alive.
Yes, I think it was somebody in the chat room, and I've taken turpentine. I've taken it a number of times. In fact, I bought a gallon of it, a gallon, plus I have a couple of bottles in my cabinet in my bathroom, and I just want to make sure I have sufficient, because I think it's a very good product, and it is an essential oil. So, something that I've gotten into recently. Oh, it was 30-06. Okay, he just
yeah.
he admitted it. He's in the chat room.
Yeah,
and he said, "Yep, it was him," and he yet lives. He is yet alive, and that's been some time. So, we're glad that he is still alive.
It must have been about 4 or 5 months ago.
Yes, yes, and he's alive.
I've tried afterwards, checked around at hardware stores and so, but I couldn't find any turpentine that's natural turpentine that was made from spruce.
Uh-huh, yeah, spruce extract. You can get it on eBay.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's a place that I got this gallon. It was down south. I would have to look at the gallon to see where I got it. But, it's really good for you, and I think that it's really good for animals, too.
Yeah, as I say, what heals human beings, it probably heals most of the animals, too.
Right, yeah. Right. So tell us about your farm now. Do you still have... 30-06 said he used the hardware stuff. So,
yeah.
But tell us about your animals.
Diana, last fall, after this debacle there on the 23rd of September, you know,
mm-hmm.
What I'd gone through the previous few years, especially during the winter,
mm-hmm.
I did not think that I would be able to properly care for the animals through the winter, because I was getting gassed and my health was taking its toll too. You know,
yeah.
And I expected any time the previous years, you know, that I would go the same way than many of my neighbors, that I just plain would keel over of a massive heart.
No.
You know, about 4 years ago, the same thing happened to my friend Marianne, who had come up from New York.
Mm-hmm.
She stayed here for pretty near a year. Then on the 2nd of July, those... I call them bastards, you know, that
mm-hmm.
have often killed my cattle,
mm-hmm.
driving by every 3 hours and focusing this energy on the shoulder of the road just only 30 feet upwind from the house, you know, and then that modifies the atmospheric air, and then this this modified atmospheric air that's made up out of high concentration of ozone and nitrogen oxides. Basically, nitrogen oxides is a deadly gas. In Mayen, she came down with a massive heart attack, and within 3/4 of an hour, she had passed away. But I've been following up what happened to those trees I had planted there in 1989. They went, the trees that survived it, they went dormant. It stayed at 2 or 3 feet for the next 10, 12 years.
Oh, my gosh.
Spruce trees? Spruce trees and fir trees. I took pictures over the years all along. You know? And now the last couple of years, they have some green growth on top. But other areas where that energy hadn't been focused there, those trees, they are now about 20 feet tall.
Wow.
See, I've been always cross-referencing.
Yes.
And documenting it. And here in New Brunswick, got the highest concentration of university on the North American continent. And I've had some of those so-called experts here, you know.
Right.
And most of them, they're not worth the powder to be blown to hell. They're either specialized idiots, and when they finally get it, you know, they're too damn chicken.
Yes.
Speak out. But now here, basically it comes to a crunch with the forestry industry. Most of the woodlands are clear-cut, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Plantations they have established. You know, it takes them at least 45 years for them to come on online, that they can harvest them again. Now this, especially in southern New Brunswick, this company, the Irving Companies, they are doing the, have been doing the same devastation in Maine and down the New England coast. And
wow.
What I understand in talking to people there, this company, you know, this it's a family company, family compound, the Irvings, you know, they are the most favored citizens there.
Favored. Wow. Uh-huh. One of the things that you mentioned in the last week or so, you said that the local authorities had accused you of mistreating or abusing your animals.
I was not supposed to have fed them enough and properly. And I was not supposed to have provided them with water, proper water. And I was, the last time I was supposed to solicit the services of a veterinarian was in 2009. And I presented all the evidence, bills and pictures,
mm-hmm.
from 2010, 2011, from vet bills to the vet stand right in my dooryard,
mm-hmm.
when I had called them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then about not properly feeding, over the years, I always made sure that I had at least 1.5 times as much hay supply for the winter than what I needed.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first went back into cattle there there about 19 years ago, this bunch, they started pulling off the same stunts again within a few months, what they had done in 1975 and 76 about killing my cattle.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police covered it up, and upon false accusation, I was being put twice into the loony bin. And afterwards, when I wanted to get the information under the Freedom of Information Act, wanted to get my files, all the reasons, or most of the reasons why I was being picked up were being blacked out.
Oh.
You know. And basically the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, their allegiance is not to serve and protect the people of Canada, but their allegiance is to serve and protect each other and to protect the crown.
Wow.
You know.
Yes.
You don't know how much corruption and evil there is below the surface, you know, unless you get thrown into that river with that dirty water and all those critters that are crawling around underneath the surface.
Sure.
You know.
And you said something. You said they acted like they were so concerned about your animals, but that when they threw you in jail, they weren't considering your animals, and there was nobody at your ranch to take care of the animals when they threw you in jail, and they did not allow you to make any arrangements, even for your dog.
as I say, you know, I said that to the judge in court when he ordered to have me put in jail. I was supposed to be taken to a psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
And I pointed out somebody needs to look after the cattle. And my dog was still locked up in the house because I didn't want him to run on the road.
Sure,
you know.
Sure.
And I wanted to make a phone call to a lawyer to get some legal advice.
Mm-hmm.
And my car was still on the parking lot of the jail. I wanted to make a phone call to a friend to pick my car up so I didn't have to pay any towing charges and any storage charges. The only phone call that was allowed was to a neighbor to pick let my dog out of the house. And
wow.
They took him for the next few days over to their place.
Wow.
You know? But while I was in jail, $320 were stolen out of my wallet. My car racked up $261 in towing charges. And when I was being brought back into the court on the 23rd, you know, and I want to thank you that you and my friends, that they appeared, you know, to make a phone call.
Yes, we made several phone calls.
Yeah, and as I say, it created a kind of embarrassing situation for the courts there, you know.
Good.
When my friends made a phone call and asked to relay birthday wishes. So,
yes. Yes.
But anyway, I still haven't got my money back. You know, I still haven't got the reimbursed about the towing charges, you know. But when I was being brought back on the 23rd, the judge, Troy Sweet, asked me, did you see a psychiatrist? And I said, no, Your Honor. The only medical professional I saw was a nurse that was who was measuring my blood pressure.
Wow.
But anyway, they made so many, they kept me, there was a wrongful application of Section 110 of the Provincial Offences Procedures Act. They can apply it only at the onset of a trial or during a trial. And the trial portion had been over on the 25th of June.
Wow.
Basically, they broke so many laws.
They sure did. And you were aware of those. You know the law enough that you acted in your own behalf.
Well, as I say, they offered me a duty counselor. But what I had encountered before, a few years earlier with the Department of the Environment, were two inspectors, so-called inspectors for the Department of Environment. They cooked up a story, and that happened to be two former RCMP officers, and one of the RCMP officers, he interfered in 1986 and covered up destruction of evidence.
Wow.
Morris Fleming. Sergeant Morris Fleming. They perjured themselves in court, wrote false reports and everything, and at the time I wasn't familiar with the court system, so I hired a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went lawyer shopping, one lawyer said to me, the one who defends himself in court is a fool for a lawyer. And what I found out in the meantime, with most of the cases in front of the court, if you hire a lawyer and pay a lawyer money, you know, you're an even bigger fool.
Yeah, I agree with you. Absolutely. But you do have to know what you're doing, and apparently you've...
As I say, I got... this was a completely unfamiliar territory, and, you know, when you have been a farmer all your life, you know, you have to think on your feet.
Sure. And you've done that. It's amazing to me the things that you've been able to do, because you are a farmer, because you've taken care of all these animals, you actually have done your own physical investigation of some of the animals that have perished as a result of the assault against them, in as much as you have, well, performed autopsies, correct?
Diana, I've done at least around 80 autopsies, and I time and time again try to talk to the veterinarian, Andy Seng-Onge, Carl Dingy, and who they were all, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just plain simple science. I showed them the autopsy photos, and they did some autopsies, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But they did not follow up. And then the district veterinarian, he said to me, when I referred him to all the evidence pointed to, with the burns on the noses of the animals and everything, it pointed to the use of directed energy devices,
mm-hmm.
or like lasers or masers, a technology that has been around between 50 and 60 years.
Right.
This veterinarian, he answered me, we are not trained on it. And I said, pardon me, we all have to, if you're in the profession, you have to constantly do your upgrading.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And I have to do it as a farmer, and you have to do it too.
Sure. But they have what is called, I think, in veterinary veterinarian medicine, the same as in allopathic medicine, they have what is called a standard of care, and they are licensed to perform according to that standard of care, and they cannot think outside of the box or go against, they have certain medications that they give for certain things.
See, there, for example, when they had massive corrosive damage to the lungs and to the stomach, their standard medication was pump them full of antibiotics.
Right.
And 3 hours later, they were dead anyway. And I was stuck with another vet bill of $230,
$250. Right,
right. You know, basically they wanted to financially exhaust me.
Yes.
You know, instead of addressing the problem, you know, about documenting the severe burns on the animals, the holes that were burned right into the others. And in one occasion, I phoned up the RCMP, and I phoned up the veterinarian, Andy St. Ons. The veterinarian came with 3 RCMP officers, and I point the third degree burn on the udder of a cow. And he said to the RCMP officers, I don't see nothing. I've ordered.
Wow.
You know, and the count prosecutor, when I presented 22 points of evidence, which include most of them, included pictures of the injuries to the animals, externally and internally, and the count prosecutor wanted to say, oh, those are just pictures.
Wow.
A picture says 1,000 words, and then he asked, where did you take the pictures? Were they taken on your farm? I said, do you think I went over to a neighbor and cut a neighbor's cow open? And he was basically asking so stupid question. So I questioned his competence, you know.
You're remarkable. You are absolutely remarkable.
No.
Yes, you are.
As I say, when you get thrown into the water, you have to swim if you don't want to drown.
Exactly.
And somehow the Lord gave me the right words and the right responses, you know.
Yes,
but
yes, indeed.
But anyway, I threw him so many curveballs, you know.
Right.
I think they are on the 19th of June. He was glad that he was out of there, but he is not out of there. Because this was malicious prosecution, because I'd given the count prosecutor right when I was being called to court on the 21st of November 2011, when I was being called into court, you know, right afterwards I went to see him personally and I gave him Farmer's Ordeal, the documentary.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. And that's available on YouTube. In fact, we have a link to it on the schedule page where you tell your story.
Yeah, and I asked him to have a look at it and reconsider if he really wanted to go ahead with the trial.
Right.
But he went ahead anyway. And the same documentary I served to Judge Troy Sweet, I think it was on the 6th of January, and I got the receipt. I served him a farmer's ordeal in order to give him a kind of insight,
Sure.
And all through the trial, he pretended that he didn't know anything about. But just a few weeks ago, I came across across all my papers. I came across the photocopy. You know, that was when I served the judge at the judge's office.
Oh, wonderful.
The receipt, you know. And the same way, I served the same farmer's ordeal to another judge, Irving Lampert, who signed an authorization order to deliver hay. The cows wouldn't even eat, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They had plenty of hay here. They didn't want to eat that hay that was being shipped in. Courtesy of the New Brunswick SPCA. You people who donate to the SPCA, I hope you're glad that you donated those at least $400 or $500 for that hay. It is still packed there beside the road. The fellow who bought the hay with an RCMP escort and with the order from the judge that I had to leave them, let them on the property, so I took pictures of them.
Mm-hmm.
RCMP officer. And one of the officer, White, when I didn't get his name tag right on the picture, you know,
mm-hmm.
I said, excuse me, I didn't get your name tag on. So I stepped right in his face. And Marianne, at the time, she said, I saw you already laying shot dead on the ground.
Wow. Well, what they did to your animals is just absolutely
those
terrible.
Those are monsters, and they've done the same thing with people. And they got away with it because the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, those super cops, they let them get away with it.
Right.
And they're looking for UFOs and aliens.
Right, that's what they're accusing you of doing. That's what they're accusing you of. They're trying to make you look like you're crazy.
But they are the crazy ones, or they are the lazy ones.
Right.
And what happened there in Moncton there a few weeks ago, where three Mounties got shot dead and two others got injured, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I spoke to Moncton on Main Street, you know, when we had just come from the courthouse, and I invited my friends that came to the court in order to support me. I invited them to a lunch at Subway, you know. And when we were walking, we had parked the car on the side street, and we were walking along Main Street there for about, I think, at least 2 weeks. Moncton got policed by RCMP from outside New Brunswick, you know. So I spoke to a couple officers, a young female officer. I said, where are you from? And she said, I'm from Nova Scotia, you know. And then I filled her in about where the Moncton RCMP had already knowledge for two months previously on two different occasions. I had given them, including their chief, Marianne Snowman, I had given her evidence where one officer under her charge had posted 5 years ago the most malicious hate speech, allowed it to be posted in their YouTube site, where I was being called a Nazi war criminal that killed 6 million Jews and I should have been hung in Nuremberg.
Oh my gosh.
My dad was a war criminal that got executed in Israel.
Oh my gosh.
And then a threat, I would like to come and kill some more of your cows. And as soon as I read that on the internet, a friend of mine who was staying here, David, he copied it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then I phoned up Sergeant Morris Como. At the time, he was in District 11, the neighboring district where I'm policed from. And I phoned him up and I asked him to check out, to investigate who was posting that hate speech and who was posting those threats.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, and for heaven's sake, take it off the internet. He let it to be posted for another 3 weeks on the internet before the YouTube site got shut.
Wow. And I know people in the chat room who have had their YouTube channels totally eliminated because they were telling the truth.
No, this was the RCMP.
Right.
The YouTube site had been set up because over a period of time there was a rash of arsons in back of Salisbury, you know, and they got one of the arsonists. on a surveillance camera, as he just was dousing an accelerant onto an already a fire in progress.
Ah.
So the RCMP, you know, this Officer Como, he did some grandstanding on television so that the RCMP is now making even use of the internet in order to catch criminals, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then halfway through, there were about 700 comments were being already posted, you know. The RCMP asked that people give input if they knew that the fella,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Uh-huh.
And about 700 comments had been posted, and then David, posted a comment and asked, and how about the farmers in the back countries that are being terrorized by having their big round hay bales burned 5, 6, 3, 4 hay bales at a time?
Wow.
I had 11 cases of arson over a period of half a year.
You're kidding, really? Okay.
To a grand total of pretty near 50 big round hay bales.
About
50 pound hay bales being burned. And the only response I got from the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, don't bother me the next time. You wrote about it, you know. Two officers, they come in the yard just about getting dark. One in uniform and the other one, I understood it was a trainee, a young black fella. And I thought, where did they pick him up? Did they pick him up in downtown Montreal or Toronto, you know?
Uh-huh.
And he was sporting an old Colt on the side. And my dog was doing a little bit barking, you know, and I wanted to usher him out. There was a small gate and usher him in the house. And this bald-headed Mountie, just blocked the way of my dog Teddy, and Teddy did a little bit growling, but there was nothing serious,
uh-huh.
And the Mountie yapped at me, control your dog or you're going to shoot him.
Yeah, and people here in this country have lost a lot of their pets lately because the police will come in, and even if a dog isn't threatening or doesn't say anything, doesn't growl, they'll shoot dogs. It is just amazing. Amazing.
But anyway, you know, I looked at the situation, and the year earlier, Mounty said, in that case, a young black fella in Vancouver, they tasered a poor Polish immigrant who didn't speak English. They tasered him to death. Zikanski. And I looked at the situation. I thought, better be careful, you know. One wrong move or so, and you're laying beside your dog, and they cook up a story.
Right.
So the next day, I phoned up at the detachment and filed a complaint about that officer.
Mm-hmm.
And the dispatcher who picked up the phone, he asked, did you see a yellow streak behind them on the ground when they were walking down the driveway?
Ah. Wow, that's an interesting comment.
Because 2 or 3 years earlier, I had chased a Mountie, Officer Susie,
mm-hmm.
who overstepped his authority. I chased him out of my pasture.
Good for you. Good for you. I am just amazed at your courage and the things that you have done.
Anyway, look, Dan, when you deal with animals that are a few times as big as you are, that can do you in no time. And I've had a few close calls, you know. If you want to do that job, do your job, you can't be chicken all the time.
Sure. You just have to keep doing what is the right thing to do. And you've certainly done that in the face of a lot of opposition. It is just amazing. And
but Diana, look. When they cannot pull anything through with the police or with the judicial system, then basically, as a last resort, psychiatric whores to the rescue.
Yeah.
And we got lots of psychiatric whores, and they've destroyed a lot of people's lives.
Oh,
and
they have.
It's high time that the judiciary clean up their act and then go after those psychiatrists that have committed so many horrendous crimes and sweep it underneath the carpet. And with my friend Judy Day.
Yes. How's she doing?
Well, she's holding her own.
Good.
But there has to be something we want to see. There is still no provision in the law, but the regulation or whatever, how they do it. When psychiatrists are involved in any kind of a court case as a witness, then any kind of a session with a psychiatrist has to be recorded. And not that the psychiatrist can make up stories on their own in order to do the dirty work for what some crooked members in the judiciary couldn't accomplish and in the police.
Well, years ago, the psychiatrists said that they were going to take over the court system, the school system, the medical system, and certainly they have done that with the court system because they have a lot of sway with no medical evidence behind some of their claims. I mean, they just those are opinions that they give. They have no medical evidence to support them.
And Diane, I think I mentioned it on the show, all the psychiatrists I encountered, they came from third world countries.
Oh, yeah, you did mention that, yes.
They came from Pakistan, they came from India, they came from Bangladesh, and they came from Nigeria.
Sure.
That was the last one. She cooked up her own story, but I figure when I was being brought there the second time from jail to the mental health center there, in the evening, I had a good impression about her. But then in the back of my mind, I thought, well, if she gets enough pressure, she is going to turn 180 degree turnaround.
Of course.
And that's exactly a day and a half later when I read the report she wrote, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I said to the judge, I said, Your Honor, please disregard this report. At least 30% of what's written in there, it's in the imagination of that Dr. Akin Mokun.
Wow.
You know, can be easily proven by the evidence that's in the evidence folder you are in possession of and the count prosecutor is in possession of. You know? And then the count prosecutor, he jumped around, oh, yeah, his mental health record. And I said, Your Honor, please admonish the count prosecutor that he never mentioned it again unless he produces it in court. I said, I've been trying to get my mental health record for the last 38 years. I wasn't able to get it, you know.
Wow.
Unless he produces it in court. But just on his say-so, it's basically hearsay.
Right.
It's not admissible in a court of law. And
right.
When he produces it in court, then I demand that the whole case be dismissed, because the count has failed to provide full disclosure in reasonable time before the trial.
You're amazing. You're just amazing.
No.
Yes, you are. I know you're a humble man, but you are amazing that you would take on the court system in the way that you have done, and that you have learned enough to take care of, well, that's that independent German thinking again. That is fabulous that you are taking care, you are independent.
Diana, my friend Marianne.
Mm-hmm.
Marianne Hennen, she had for last few decades facing up to crooked police and crooked court and crooked social services and mental health services. And when she was down in Florida, she attended a course, and the fellow who gave the lecture, who led the course, he said, anybody can defend himself in court, even an 8-year-old child.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Sure.
And when you defend yourself in court, there's something else. The judge has to make allowances.
Oh, okay.
And he has to guide you along.
He's compelled to do that. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people don't know that. Oh, my goodness, we're running out of time.
Sorry.
Oh, thank you so much for being on the program today. I'm just so happy to know you, so happy to count you as my friend, and I just
Diana,
admire you so much.
No, don't admire me. Look, if I wouldn't have been confronted with those situations I've been confronted with over the last 38 years, I probably would be nearly just as ignorant as most of the people are.
But you weren't. You took a hold of the bull by its horns, and you, I call you a survivor. I do. You're a survivor because you accepted the responsibility for your own actions, and you learned what you needed to learn in order to do that. And I just admire you so much. So thank you so much for being on the program.
And Diane, and thank you, you know, for the, you are basically to be admired the way you are hanging in there. And this is basically a responsibility we have toward our fellow men. When we see danger coming to our fellow men, we have to warn them.
Exactly. Well, thank you, and goodbye. Goodbye, listeners. We'll talk to you soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Diane.
Bye-bye.
Bye.